And Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs near 24. Again, blustery northwest winds. Thanks for choosing KAXE. Time now for As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens,
An Inconvenient Truth. The renowned author of books such as The Inconvenient Indian about Indigenous people and issues says he has learned that he has no Cherokee ancestry, as he long believed. An Anishinaabe columnist who's known Thomas King for years says that revelation is a gut punch.
And building the absolute best mousetrap, we'll pay tribute to the great toy inventor Bert Meyer, who had light bulb moment after light bulb moment, literally, in coming up with Light Bright, figuratively in the case of Rock'em Sock'em Robots and Mousetrap.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXE. Support comes from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We're going to sample our album of the week now. It's called Vendrán Suaves Lluvias by Silvana Estrada. She is a Mexican singer-songwriter with her second album. Her debut won her the Best New Artist at the Latin Grammys, and the intricate arrangements range from peaceful and delicate to sweeping and immense, sometimes within the same song. You can read more about it at KAXE.org. Look for fresh picks. The song we're going to hear from Silvana Estrada is called Flores.
Yo no puedo más con esta espera. Viviendo a la sombra de otro amor. Si yo para ti soy un problema, si escondes a la luna, no brilla el sol. Son instantes que oscilan temerosas junto a ti. Si acaso mi cariño es un dilema, toma fuerza o déjalo morir. Ya no hay campo. Vámonos dejando a un lado, que donde no crecen flores, yo no canto. Estás cambiando, o si después de tal o no había más, de breve aparición seré en tu vida para no darle a la gente de qué hablar. Ya no hay campo.
no canto, yo no canto.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
identity crisis. Anishinaabe columnist Negan Sinclair says the news that renowned author Thomas King is not Indigenous is a painful breach of trust and demands that Canada ask itself some serious questions.
Thrown out of the deep end after violating anti-doping rules, swimmer Penny Oleksiak, Canada's most decorated female Olympian, is banned from competition for 2 years.
Feeling badly burned, the fire that destroyed a historic Toronto church is being investigated as arson. The priest in charge tells us that news is yet another blow for her congregation.
Changing our minds. A new study reveals that the human brain goes through 5 distinct phases, and the adolescence phase might be longer than you think.
Slow motion replay. We'll say goodbye to a beloved Galapagos tortoise named Grandma and revisit our conversation about a tortoise named Mommy who became a mother for the very first time at the approximate age of 100.
And game changer. The late legendary toy inventor Bert Meyer made success look like child's play by creating such all-time diversions as Light Bright, Mousetrap, and the Slugfest Rock'em Sock'em Robots. As it happens, the Tuesday edition. Radio that's glad he didn't pull any punchers. The author of The Inconvenient Indian says he is, quote, not an Indian at all, unquote. The renowned Canadian-American author Thomas King made that admission in a Globe and Mail interview and op-ed. For decades, Mr. King has maintained that he is part Cherokee from Oklahoma on his father's side, which his mother told him when he was growing up in California. He spent his life writing about that fact and about Indigenous people and culture and winning awards for that writing. But recently, Tribal Alliance Against Frauds, an organization, as its name suggests, that exposes false claims of Native American heritage, informed the 82-year-old writer that there is, in fact, no Cherokee ancestry in his family tree. Negan Sinclair is a professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Manitoba and a columnist with the Winnipeg Free Press, which is where he wrote about his reaction to the news. We reached Mr. Sinclair in Winnipeg.
Negan, in his Globe and Mail piece, Thomas King writes that he is still in shock over all of this. How is it hitting you?
Well, I mean, there is not one person who has worked in Indigenous studies or Indigenous literature, or frankly, anything involving Canadian literature that hasn't heard of Tom King. Mm-hmm. To hear that he didn't search his own identity and let others do it is not only extremely disappointing, but it destabilizes many of our trajectory of our careers. And for many Indigenous scholars and writers like myself, it's very upsetting. It also makes us mistrust not just people who at their word say that they know their identity, but we then begin to question everything. And it's not only painful, it's also, I think, a blemish on the entire Canadian literary industry as a whole, to not check and to not ask questions and let a person who take up so much space win so much awards and take up so much space.
He also wrote in that piece that he understands a lot of people might be asking or wondering if he knew all along, you know, that he was not Cherokee. He says that is not true, that he believed what he was told, that his father's biological father was part Cherokee. You know, how do you balance the complicated history that many people have while also advocating for accountability and clarity from people who are doing work like Thomas King has been doing.
Well, we all have complicated identities, mm-hmm. you know? Every Indigenous person has different cultures, races, stories of displacement, identity loss, residential schools. Like, we all have these complicated histories. But what we have to do is we often have to legitimate ourselves in different contexts and localities, especially when it comes to the work that we do in our own communities. Like, people ask questions and we have to give answers. And to be for so long not only displaced from your territory, if he is, you know, as his family is claimed from Oklahoma, you have to reconnect. You have to be able to answer the questions necessary, and people will trust you because you have said that you've done the work. But the fact is that he didn't do the work. He let others do the work for him. And while I have a great deal of empathy for anybody with a complicated identity, I think of many of our survivors of the child welfare system who maybe don't know where they come from. And it is, the onus is on some of us who do have abilities and resources to be able to help people. If you don't even ask for help, to be able to reconnect and to find out the answers for the stories that are the most critical, then what happens is you create a mess for everybody else to clean up. And that's really what's created now, is that we all have this situation on our hands where we don't only have to revisit elements of our career and rewrite and rethink a lot of the things that we've been working on because we built it on trust, but we also are now in a situation of mistrusting and harm that's been created as a result of this process.
What do you say to people who are feeling destabilized and, you know, don't feel that they can trust people who they trusted? How do you process this personally and then advise others to deal with it?
I mean, harm is something that's real for every Indigenous person. Like, we know how to cope with it. We know how to support each other, and most importantly, how to recover and rebuild. What it does tell you, though, is this really tells you about a question of the Canadian literary landscape and the Canadian culture as a whole. Why is it that so many of these individuals who have very dubious and problematic claims to Indigenous communities have taken up so much space for such a long period of time? And I'm not just thinking of Thomas King anymore. I'm thinking about others that have said things, called themselves inconvenient or not the Indian you had in mind, and then taken up all this space to influence the way that we are seen. And real life Indigenous person, why is it that the Canadian landscape needs so many people that perhaps have said things that don't fully encapsulate or only partially draw upon, often through stereotypes, Indigenous experiences, and then have such a huge impact on the rest of us? And that's really, I think, what the big question, or the thing we might learn the most from this situation, is why is it that Canada keeps needing these very big figures that have impacted real life Indigenous peoples?
You write in your piece that you met Thomas King through your father, the late Maurice Sinclair. And there were rumors swirling, and Thomas King writes about this as well, that he knew that there were rumors swirling and they would go away. What did you talk about? What did you say to your father? What kind of conversations did you have with him?
Well, I've heard these rumors going back for over a decade for sure, maybe even longer. And I remember going to my father and talking about it. And my father, because of his long relationship with Thomas King, he trusted him. Mm-hmm. And my father said, you know, I take him at his word. He says that he's done the research. He says that he's investigated, and while complicated, and who doesn't have a complicated relationship with their past, as I mentioned before, I believe him. And I believe my father, and I'm actually very happy that he is not seeing a day like this, because I know he would be profoundly disappointed. And I also know that he would really want all of us to choose better paths and look at the work that we are doing and hold to account those who are doing the work necessary to build relationships with communities through understanding their paths more fully and completely. And I don't think in any ways he would want any of us to create more harm. But I think what he would want is he would want us all to turn towards those authors that perhaps we have overlooked in the past, that didn't win those awards, that didn't take up the great amount of space, and revisit those authors and give them some attention.
Negan, I appreciate this. Thank you as always.
Oh, miigwech. Thanks so much.
Negan Sinclair is a professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Manitoba and a columnist with the Winnipeg Free Press. He's in Winnipeg. It's been a hard year and a half for the congregation of St. Anne's Church in Toronto, and this week they got the wind knocked out of them once again. In June of 2024, fire destroyed the historic building. That marked the loss of a treasured gathering place, but also of a magnificent monument. The church was home to several significant works of art, including some by members of the Group of Seven. The loss stunned the community, and now, after months of investigation, Toronto police have confirmed the shocking news that the fire is being treated as suspected arson. Hannah Johnston is the priest in charge of St. Anne's. We reached her in Toronto.
Reverend, I know you've been speaking with your parishioners. How are they taking this news?
Yes, it was a big shock to many of the congregation when we shared the news with them on Sunday after the morning service. Obviously, we always knew that this could be a possibility, but it was a real shock and surprise for most of our parishioners, and very upsetting and painful news to hear, especially so long after the fire. Yeah. I think it really felt like reopening a wound for many people that had started to heal, and a revisiting of the grief and the trauma that we experienced when the fire happened in June 2024.
And what are police telling you at this point? Because initially they said that they did not believe it was suspicious. So what changed? What have they told you?
That's right. So the police detective in charge of the case has been working alongside us since the beginning. He's been absolutely wonderful, and so have the fire investigation officers. But the detective shared with the congregation on Sunday that it is suspected arson, and that they found multiple origin points for the fire around the interior of the church. So that was the information that he was able to share with us.
And suspects or motive or anything like that at this point, they haven't shared?
Nothing like that at this point, no.
I can only imagine, Reverend, being there. I mean, were there gasps in the room when the investigator says that?
There were, and there were some tears, as you would expect. And, we were successful in being able to hold that meeting in private and give our parishioners the privacy to receive this news and be able to begin to process this and ask questions of the detective before anything else was shared outside of that meeting. And so that was a really important time for us, just to be with our people and to provide kind of pastoral care and support and conversation even after the meeting was over. Yeah. and throughout this week as well.
What do you say to people to comfort them as these wounds, as you said, are being reopened while people are still grieving?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we're really sharing our own grief alongside folks at the moment. This building was more than a building to our parishioners. It was a sacred space that was connected to many memories for families going back generations of baptisms, weddings, and funerals. And so we're really just being present for people to listen and provide comfort and pastoral support in any way that we can.
The rebuilding process is ongoing, as I understand it. You are gathering, as you've mentioned, for services. Mm-hmm. Where is that happening?
So that's happening in our parish hall, which is on the same property. So we really feel very fortunate to have such a large parish hall that we've been able to move all of our church services over into there and continue worshiping and serving on this site that we've been in for so many years. And the rebuilding is ongoing. We are in the early stages of working with the diocese and with a firm of architects to begin to really dream and plan and hope for what the new St. Anne's building will look like. And that's a really exciting and hopeful thing for the congregation to focus on at this time as well.
And when do you expect... I mean, when do you imagine that you'll be back in this newly rebuilt church?
I mean, we don't really have a clear timeline on that yet. That will depend on many things like fundraising and working with Heritage and also working with City planning and all those kinds of things. So we're just in the very early days of that at the moment. But even just being able to see some pictures and look at things like square footage and planning for this new building does really bring a sense of excitement and hope back to the congregation.
Yeah, I can understand that, certainly. Mm-hmm. Our listeners may remember in the aftermath of the fire, there was artwork inside. Some pieces were saved, and there was a restoration process. Where does that stand now?
That's right. So the artwork in the church was the only known religious artwork by members of the Group of Seven. And they were actually canvases which were glued onto the dome rather than being painted on there. And really that was what was able to save some of them in the heat of the fire. The glue melted and the canvases peeled off and fell into the ashes. And three of those canvases were deemed to be restorable. So they have just completed the first stage of restoration, which is cleaning. Mm-hmm. And the congregation were able to see them a couple of months ago, which was wonderful. Yeah. So we are hoping to be able to re-include those into the new build as well.
People in your position, leaders such as yourself, you know, you are there to help guide people through the losses and experiences in their lives. But this is something, Reverend, that obviously happened to you as well in a mm-hmm. place you care mm-hmm. about. So how are you doing?
Well, thank you for asking. It's obviously been a very difficult period for all of us at St. Anne's. I don't have as long a connection with the building and with this place as many of my parishioners, but I have been here on and off since 2019 when I first moved to Canada. And this was one of the very first places that welcomed me when I was new to this country. And so it really has a very special place in my heart. So it has been a difficult time, but I feel very well supported by the bishop and the diocese at this time. And also I've just been really touched by parishioners checking in on me and asking how I'm doing. This is a community that cares for one another, and I really saw people caring for each other well on Sunday after the meeting in the wake of this news.
Reverend, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hannah Johnston is the priest in charge of St. Anne's Church. We reached her in Toronto. For the next few minutes, it's not a cold November night in 2025. It is a Saturday morning. The year is whatever year it was when you were 6 years old. You pour milk into a bowl full of colors that do not exist in nature and turn on the TV. And sometimes the commercials transfix you even more than the cartoons. Like this one, where two kids control robot boxers, jabbing at each other until their heads literally pop off their shoulders.
Oh, my block is knocked off.
But you can press it right back on. It's Rock'em Sock'em Robots. Press this lever. He throws a right, the other a left. Knock his block off. You're the winner.
Wait till next time.
You can Rock'em Sock'em with the Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Or this one, where you build a Rube Goldberg-style contraption to ensnare a pesky rodent.
The wildest, funniest game you've ever seen.
And if you're feeling groovy, a toy that lets you create your very own desktop psychedelic light show.
You can make lots of pretty pictures with Light Bright from Hasbro.
Amazingly, one man was behind all three of those classic toys and many, many more. Bert Meyer, who died this week at the age of 99. Tim Walsh is a toy designer himself. He profiled Mr. Meyer in his book, Timeless Toys, Classic Toys, and the Playmakers Who Created Them. We reached him in Sarasota, Florida.
Tim, when you were growing up, long before you ever met Bert, were you a Rock'em Sock'em Robots kind of kid or more of a Light Bright type?
I was definitely a Rock'em Sock'em Robots kid. I loved that toy. It was I wrote about it several times, but I said before video games, that was the game that gave kids sore thumbs. because you would try to, you know, knock your opponent's block off. But love that game.
Yeah, I don't think I had a Light Bright, but I do remember. I think I had lots of toys. I was lucky, but I think, you know, if you're lucky, you had a friend who had it, and then you would, you know, turn off the lights and make all the designs. You've made a career of being obsessed with toys now. Did playing with the toys that he created send you down this path?
I think so, because I just, you know, we were a very athletic family. We were outside playing quite a bit, but, you know, of course, there's rainy days and you go inside, and I always wondered who made this thing. And it's, as I got older and entered the toy industry, it's astonishing to me that a toy like Light Bright, which is probably sold, I'm guessing, because Hasbro doesn't always disclose their numbers, but at least 25 million copies since it was released in 67. That's a 25 times platinum record if it's the music industry, or a huge selling book if it's a novel. And very few people know who Bert Meyer was. So it's neat.
And then you meet him. You meet the man. What was that like?
Yes. Well, I met him over the phone first. I interviewed him for my book, but then I did a documentary film called Toyland. And yes, I got to meet him. We pulled up to his house. And the license plate on his car said Toy King, which tickled me. And then I met him, and he was as warm in person as he was on the phone. And 84 at the time, this was about 15 years ago, and just as sharp as a tack. So it was really fun to pick his brain and just talk toys with him.
And would you describe him as a child at heart? Like, was that the point of connection to creating these toys? What was at the heart of it for him?
Yes, I do think so. You know, he had a long ponytail at the age of 84, and he's a pilot, and we had made an agreement that we were going to talk first, and then if there was time, go up in his plane.
If there was time.
And if there was time, and at the end of this two-hour interview, I thought, oh, this isn't going to happen. So I said, Bert, we can't go to the airport. We got to get to our next interview across the state. So I'm sorry. He goes, well, why don't we come out to the garage? And we go out to the garage, and there's his plane.
Did you have any hesitation about getting into it?
Well, like I said, he was 84 at the time, but he was so sharp and so with it that we did not even second guess it. So there was three of us, the cameraman, the director, and myself. And we piled in the back of his plane and took off, and he showed us the sights. And he was upset with the landing. He wasn't happy with the landing, but I remember all of us were just, we're happy to be on the ground.
And we'll leave that at that. What an amazing experience. Yeah. So I hear that he loved cycling as well. Clearly a gregarious, like a person who loves life. What did he tell you about where his ideas for some of his biggest hit toys came from?
Yeah, Light Bright was walking down the street and seeing a store display of brightly colored light bulbs, and a couple other people that worked for Marvin Glass and Associates and him commented, wow, wouldn't a kid love to play with that? But of course, you can't have a kid playing with light bulbs, so they sort of dismissed it. But like a lot of ideas, it's like, well, how do we do it anyway? Yeah. And it really was clever that they put a piece of black paper over top the light source. And when a kid took a translucent peg and pierced that black paper to plug, quote unquote, the light bulb in, that translucent piece of plastic lit up in the fingertips of kids. So it really was a clever toy because, you know, you can imagine in your room with the lights off and you plug that bulb in and it lights up. That's pretty cool.
Just as you described how that happens, I heard the sound, I felt the puncture, like you took me right back. It is a visceral experience. And like I said, I did not own one. So just even playing with it just a couple of times, it does not leave you. So that's certainly part of his legacy. But I wonder if you'd spoken to him in recent years, how he felt about, you know, the resurgence of Light Bright, for example, because of Stranger Things, you know, 80s nostalgia. There's a Rock'em Sock'em Robots movie project in the works. Vin Diesel is behind that. Yeah. So what did he think of this resurgence?
I did not speak to him to know, you know, his feedback on that. But I know he was tickled because he just loved Light Bright and was so proud of it. In fact, I, for my book, Timeless Toys, found a Light Bright prototype because I saw the letters peeling off the side of the box in the showroom, and I was like, is that a prototype? And I ended up getting it, and I knew I had to get it into his hands after I had it photographed for my book. So I called him up and said, hey, I think you need to have this original prototype from Toy Fair. And he was so thrilled with that. And he told me when I interviewed him that he would say to people, you know, oh, I'm a toy inventor. And then inevitably people say, oh, anything I heard of? And he would say Light Bright. And these 50-year-old, you know, men and women would be like, oh, my gosh, I love that toy as a kid. And he just lit up when he told that story. So I'm sure he'd be thrilled with Stranger Things and Toy Story and all these things happening around his toys.
Tim, I'm really glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thanks, Neil. This was fun.
Tim Walsh is a toy designer and writer. We reached him in Sarasota, Florida. Today, generations of fans are mourning the death of Grandma, a Galapagos tortoise who had lived at the San Diego Zoo for nearly a century. Unsurprisingly, Grandma was the zoo's oldest resident at the approximate age of 141. Memories are pouring in from those who remember first meeting her as a child, even riding on her back, as was once allowed, and then bringing their own children and then grandchildren to see her. She was reportedly sweet and shy and will be much missed. Grandma was, of course, a singular creature, but she did remind us of another Galapagos tortoise we told you about in April of this year, named Mommy. Mommy had just become a mother for the first time at the estimated age of 100. And Mommy, yeah, it does feel a bit uncomfortable every single time I say it, lives at the Philadelphia Zoo. Lauren Augustine is the director of herpetology there. From our archives, here's part of her conversation with Neil.
So Mommy's been with us at the Philadelphia Zoo since 1932, and she is a Western Santa Cruz Island Galapagos tortoise. And so we worked through our network of zoos here in North America to pair her up with the genetically ideal mate, which is a Brazo, who came in 2020. And we got our first clutch of viable eggs in November of 2024, which resulted in these hatchlings.
So when she laid these eggs, what was that moment like for you?
It's amazing. Particularly because she tends to nest at the end of the day. So, you know, the keepers are observing these animals and she started digging and it's just the end of the day. So you get that phone call where it's like, Mommy's digging a nest and everyone just runs over to watch and make sure that we can identify the exact area once she's done so that we can then retrieve the eggs because she obviously covers them back up and hides the nest pretty well.
So the planning, the strategizing, the patience paid off.
Yes. I mean, this is not a short-term situation with reptiles. We have to really go through usually seasonality and all kinds of triggers to get them to successfully reproduce. And so it really went phenomenally well. And she started laying eggs and just like we expected. So it was amazing to see the things happen that you plan, right? Yeah. That you know you can never be 100% with animals.
And in terms of their age, and Mommy in particular, is it normal for a tortoise to have hatchlings, to lay eggs at that age?
Galapagos tortoises can live over 150 years old. And so for her to be reproducing is not completely abnormal. But what is abnormal is that this is the first time, right? She's a first-time mom at 100.
She wanted to be sure, you guys. She just wanted to be sure.
Yeah, she just wanted to be sure. But for us to really secure her genetic lineage is just such an amazing accomplishment because she is an older animal and we are so fortunate to have gotten her paired up and get her to be this first-time mom this late in life.
From our archives, that was Lauren Augustine, director of herpetology at the Philadelphia Zoo, speaking with Neil and April about Mommy, the Galapagos tortoise.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, Canadian swimming champ Penny Oleksiak is banned from competition until the summer of 2027. Two-time Olympian Brittany McLean Campbell tells us what that means for the swimmer and her sport's future.
And a brain researcher tells us about new findings that suggest distinct phases in brain development throughout our lives and also suggest that the adolescent brain phase lasts into our 30s. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock with Headwaters. Malachi Coons, your host, and a conversation in the 11 o'clock hour between Kari Headland and Dave Simonette of Trampled by Turtles. Dave will be doing a show in Grand Rapids on Saturday evening at the Rife Center. Support comes from Klotko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at klotkobrewing.com. And we thank Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Snow tonight up to 7 inches in northeastern and north central Minnesota, 1 to 2 elsewhere.
She's Canada's most decorated female Olympian. And now the 25-year-old swimming star Penny Oleksiak has been banned from competition until the summer of 2027. Her violation has to do with what's called whereabouts. That's information that athletes who are part of a registered testing pool need to provide about their location so they can be available for drug testing. The International Testing Agency said Ms. Oleksiak committed 3 whereabouts failures within a 1-year period. In a statement today, Swimming Canada CEO Suzanne Paulin said, quote, "While we accept Penny's explanation, these were inadvertent errors and she has not used banned substances, anti-doping regulations are in place to ensure a level playing field for all athletes. We will miss Penny on the national team and hope to see her back in the pool when she is eligible," unquote. Brittany McLean Campbell is a retired Canadian competitive swimmer and 2-time Olympian. She's now a CBC Sports swimming analyst, and we reached her in Toronto.
Brittany, what message do you think this suspension sends to competitive swimmers today?
I think it really is a reminder of, you know, how severe the, I guess, consequences can be. Mm-hmm. And I think it is, although challenging, I think it's just a part of, you know, a par for the course with what it is like to be an athlete at this level. And so I think the message for swimmers today is it's a very forefront reminder to make sure they are keeping up to date with everything involved with their whereabouts, they're keeping sport clean, and that it's an unfortunate situation for swimming in this country, no doubt, but I hope it is something we can get through.
Penny Oleksiak is a huge star, so to see this happening to someone at that level, that heightens the message, does it not? The power of that message?
It absolutely heightens the message. Yeah, I think, you know, not all of us would be hearing about the situation maybe if it happened to an athlete that's on the lower level of the national team. But because it's Penny, and because, like, not only within this country, but globally, she is a very household name, I think it adds to it definitely adds a layer. It is unfortunate because this is the last way I'd want people to kind of think about Penny and reflect on Penny after everything she has achieved. And especially, you know, looking back on swimming and where it's grown to a level of, you know, starting back in 2016 when she won her first gold medal to see where it's at now, I think it's definitely disappointing to be having to talk about this. But It's definitely elevated because of the name that it's happening to, no doubt.
Most of us are hearing this word whereabouts and finding out what it means today as part of this conversation. I mean, we can deduce a little bit of what that might mean. You know, you have to tell the officials your location. It involves, you know, drug testing. But just take our listeners through what a whereabouts check-in. You know, you were a competitive swimmer. Yeah. What does that mean?
Basically, the whereabouts is how you provide a place for them to be able to contact you for a drug test. So you have to provide a 60-minute time slot every single day, and you have to submit it 90 days in advance. So basically, every quarter, you would go through and you would set the schedule that makes the most sense for you. There are, of course, exceptions. And what I mean by this is not exceptions. You still have to provide where you're going to be. But say I'm on a flight all the way to Australia, and that alone takes 20-plus hours. You have like a travel day you can note, you can give your airline information, and they understand that that's kind of a special circumstance. But in theory, you'll provide a window within every day. I know for the most part, athletes like to have the same time every day just because it's easier to remember. Often people do it early in the morning because they're like, you know, if you do it first thing when I wake up, it's easier to test, but also I know I'm going to be home, that kind of thing. So a lot less likely that somebody, a friend's going to call you to grab a bite to eat at 5 a.m. Sure. than they would at 5 p.m. So, yeah, it's a 1 hour you have to do. But I do want to mention that you are able to adjust them. So naturally, yeah. life happens. And so if anything changes in your schedule, it's now within an app or with a computer system. And you are able to just go in and adjust the hour based on things that might change in your life.
But so. it sounds like you and a lot of athletes have a system in place. But elite athletes, certainly at the level that Penny Oleksiak is at, we imagine that they have quite a team behind them. So, you know, again, this is not about it's about updating her information correctly. She yes. said she's a clean athlete. But how is it that an athlete at that level who has this much experience could have 3 whereabouts failures in a 12-month period?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't somebody reminding her?
Right. I think that there is absolutely, it's a mistake and there aren't excuses. Like, I'll be the first person to say that. I think Penny would even say that, you know, she is only responsible for herself. Does she have support? I'm sure she does. I know Swimming Canada has mentioned that they've used this as kind of a reminder to their athletes to check in if they need support or kind of stay on top of this as best they can. I was an athlete almost 10 years ago, so it's likely changed quite a bit since my day, but we used to get reminders pretty constantly. And so at the end of the day, you can only be responsible for yourself. And this was a part of the job. I think the one thing I do want to provide a bit of context with is just that, you know, you do hear 3 strike system mm-hmm. and you say, you know, like, how does something like this happen? But just a quick example, you know, maybe I'm at a doctor's or a physio appointment and it's running a bit behind. I know one time I was somewhere and my mom called me to say the testers had arrived at the house. And so I'm trying my best to get home and traffic, yeah. you know, traffic had gotten worse. And by the time I got there, I was just within the last, you know, couple minutes of my window and I just got there. But if that changes by 10 minutes, I'm getting my first strike. And then
right.
maybe the second time I have a typo in the address that I put in for my hotel. And so they show up to the Hilton Garden Inn and not the Hilton Inn or, you know, there's, I
you
don't
can see it happening.
Not to share any excuses, but I do just want to like kind of put a bit of a human element to it that things happen and life does happen. But by that third, once you do have 2 strikes, you do have to assume you're being extra cautious with this.
2 years away from competition, we're talking about a 25-year-old athlete, highly skilled, highly successful. What might this mean for Penny Oleksiak's chances at the 2028 Games? I mean, the kind of mental toll and physical toll it might take.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely takes a toll. You know, 2 years for any athlete is a challenge. Is it possible? 100%. I joke, even though it's not a joking matter, but I do joke that if anyone can do it, it's Penny. I've seen Penny do things that I never imagined were possible. And so do I think it's possible? For sure. But does this put an absolutely massive hurdle in her future Olympic journey? It does. And we'll find out as time goes on, you know, how she's going to react to it. I think mm-hmm. it's a little early to tell if she's even going to give it a go. Like, she's at a point in her career that she could decide that this is it for her. But she could also decide that she wants to go another quad. Like, we don't yeah. really know at this point. So, yeah, there's a lot of options.
Brittany, I thank you for this.
Of course. I'm happy to chat.
Thanks, Brittany.
Olympian and CBC Sports swimming analyst Brittany McLean Campbell in Toronto. If you've ever felt like you're still figuring out adulthood well into your 30s, I have great news. It's not your fault. It is your brain's. A new study from Cambridge University suggests that the human brain hits 5 distinct phases during our lifetimes, 4 of which are major turning points. Duncan Astell is a professor of neuroinformatics at Cambridge University and the senior author of the study. We reached him in Cambridge.
Professor, do you remember the moment when you were looking at the scans and realized how distinct these phases were?
Well, I certainly remember when Dr. Alexa Mosley, who's my PhD student, who was really the lead on this, well, I remember when she showed me the image, which indicated that there were these sort of turning points in brain development across the human lifespan. And so what she had done is amass this extraordinary data set, which really starts from birth and extends all the way up to someone's 90. So you imagine sort of 4,000 individuals, each with a brain scan, kind of across at different points in that age range. And what she was able to do is by assembling this enormous data set, she was able to identify that there are these sort of inflection points. So there is, it's not like our brains just change in a kind of linear way across our lifespan. There are these sort of different phases. And you can really see them in the data, these sorts of peaks when the brain seems to change the way that it's developing and sort of move into a different gear.
I think, you know, some of these phases, the age ranges that are attached to each of the phases might not surprise people. But one of them, adolescence in particular, I think might surprise people, surprise our listeners. You've got it from 9, the age of 9 years old, to 32. Many people believe that they are out of adolescence long before the age of 32.
Exactly. I mean, when I was 24 or whatever, if you'd have asked me, I'd have been pretty sure that I was an adult and I was done with my development. And so, you know, these are not ages that we've come up with. These are entirely emergent from the data. And in a way, it actually does line up with some other data from other groups showing that there are underlying kind of molecular changes in the brain that continue all the way up until we're 30 years of age. And in a way, you might be sort of thinking, why as a species do we take so long to mature and reach what we would kind of call adulthood? Mm-hmm. In reality, it makes us highly adaptive as a species, and it means that we become kind of maximally different from one another, which creates a kind of diversity, which is really good for us as a species. And so actually having this incredibly long developmental period, even though we know that actually there are vulnerabilities in that period, mm-hmm. as a species, I think it's one of our kind of the secrets of our success.
And what are the vulnerabilities in that phase when you talk about adolescence in terms of the brain?
Well, we know that around 75% of those who will experience a mental health condition will have the first onset of recognizable symptoms before they're 24. So the vast majority of kind of common mental health difficulties, like things like anxiety, depression, mood disorders, things like schizophrenia, will have their first onset somewhere in the sort of teenage years into the 20s. And so there is something about this window of time that whilst it's sort of a tremendously extended window of opportunity and possibility in the way that the brain is continually changing, we do know that statistically, if you are going to experience a mental health condition, that is most likely when it will first rear its head.
And just to underline for our listeners, it's come through in some of what you're saying, you're not suggesting with this research that the brain of a 15-year-old and a 30-year-old is in any way the same.
Not at all. So I guess what we're saying is that we describe them as turning points, right? So mm-hmm. there's one at about 9 years of age, probably when you're kind of just about to go through puberty. And then there's this really extended period of development. So massive changes across that time. But the point is there's kind of relatively linear changes across that time.
And then 32 to 66, adulthood is the era or phase that you list in your research, the longest rewiring phase, lasts more than 3 decades. What does that generally mean in how we think and how we behave?
It's a period of relative stability in the data. And that really lines up with what we know about things like cognitive development, personality, is a relatively stable period from your kind of 30s through to your kind of mid to late 60s. And then we find another one of these turning points. And in our data, it's at about 66. If you look at the data, it's quite a subtle turning point, which I think implies that it's probably quite variable across individuals.
So 66 to 83 is that early aging phase, late aging from 83 onwards. What would you say that your research shows is or suggests is the difference, the biggest difference between early and late aging?
So early aging, you see a gradual kind of increase in what we call the modularity of the brain. So the way that it is able to integrate information across different networks is gradually weakened ever so slightly. And so that's what kind of demarcates it as a phase. And then that final phase, it's really hard to map that final phase because, of course, it takes a certain kind of 85 or 90-year-old to want to come in for an MRI scan. Yeah. Right. So we've got to take that with a little bit of a pinch of salt in that as you get really towards the end of life, your sample is going to become more biased. But what we do notice in that period is that the brain starts to rely on particular regions, like particular hubs. It's a bit like saying, like, if you've got to take two buses to get somewhere, it's really important about that place where you change buses. And so it's a little bit like that in kind of moving information around the brain.
And for our listeners, wherever they're listening from, what would you hope they take away from what your research is suggesting and what you're telling us?
First thing I would say is that our brain takes such a monumentally long period of time to develop. And as a parent myself, who's kind of looking at a toddler and thinking, like, what phases is she going through? And is she walking? Is she talking? Reminding myself that actually human development takes like 30 odd years and makes me much more relaxed about the time scale. And even when I think of my own kind of early adulthood, if someone had told me that you've got a long way to go and there's time for multiple kind of chapters and phases of your life, and indeed that the neuroscience kind of tells that story, I think is kind of interesting and important. And something that's not really in our data, but that something that we think about a lot is what can we do to kind of keep our brains healthy as we inevitably kind of go through these turning points into older age? And there are some really good things that people can do, like, for instance, cardiovascular health is a really great predictor of kind of cognitive resilience in older age.
And what do you hope to do with the results from this point on?
We are really interested in development. That's primarily where we focus. And we're really interested in the variability that exists across individuals. So what we want to try and do now is understand how do these brains vary across individuals by trying to track the same individuals across time as they go through child and adolescence. And that's really what we're focusing on.
Professor, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Duncan Astill is a professor of neuroinformatics at Cambridge University, and that's where we reached him. It genuinely seemed like there was nothing Colleen Jones couldn't do. That applied to curling, and it applied to hosting on the CBC, where she bungee jumped and zip lined and roller skated, apparently without any fear whatsoever. The curling legend and longtime CBC reporter has died after a 3-year battle with cancer. She was 65 years old. Today on social media, her son Luke Saunders wrote, "Late this morning, while looking out on the ocean from her favorite spot in Maiders Cove, with my dad, brother, and myself beside her, Mom passed away. Please think of your favorite Colleen Jones moment. Cherish it. Hurry and love hard." There's a very good chance you have a favorite Colleen Jones moment that you're cherishing right now. Maybe it was when, at the age of 22, she became the youngest skip to ever win the Scotties Tournament of Hearts, before going on to later win 4 straight, or in 2022 when she was appointed to the Order of Canada, or one of her many adventurous exploits over nearly 40 years as a CBC reporter and host. She was known for telling the stories of regular Canadians. In 2023, during her farewell appearance on CBC Nova Scotia, she said, quote, "I think bringing backyard stories to the front yard and seeing the everyday heroes and everyday people is so important because there's good people out there doing amazing things," unquote. That same year, Colleen Jones sat down with the Sunday Magazine and talked about bringing those stories to light.
I think just curiosity and genuine interest in whoever was in front of me. And I remember when I started, my father said, "You're going to have to be a better listener." And I thought, that's good advice. I thought I was a good listener, but sometimes you have to listen, you have to look. I think it takes being a good listener, and I think it takes curiosity. And that's something, even in grade 7, my grade 7 teacher, Miss McKinnon, grew up on a farm in Pictou County. During recess, she would say to me, because, you know, you still had an adoration. Hopefully kids in junior high still have an adoration of their teachers. And she said, "You talk so much and you ask so many questions, you're going to be a journalist. You're going to be a journalist." And at the time you're thinking, I don't even know what a journalist is. But I think the curiosity, the wanting to ask questions, it comes from the deep in your soul, probably more than anything. I don't think everybody's born as more curious than reporters, really. We're kind of nosy and we get rewarded for it. The business we work in, the craft, is such an interesting one. You meet new people every day. No 2 days are the same. And yet you're deadline driven. And when you're in daily news, that pressure is on every day to find a story, go get the story, shoot the story, tell the story, get it on TV, get it on radio by 6 o'clock or else you're in big trouble. So to wake up with no deadlines that first day and not worrying about what story was I going to tell was actually, you know, like a pressure cooker, and you took the valve off of it. It kind of felt surreal. Now, this is the honeymoon phase probably. And I've got plans. I'm going to head to Europe next week, and I'm biking down the Rhine with my husband. We always do these Colleen Jones gets lost vacations on a bicycle where I never get the GPS quite right, or I never have the right address for wherever I found that we're staying. And then we're capping it off with my 10th Bruce Springsteen concert in Zurich on June 13th. So it's nice to have sort of a big plan right off the bat.
That's amazing. Which is the Bruce Springsteen song you most want to hear?
Every single one of them, but my anthem song for life has been Thunder Road. I mean, I've played it since whenever that came out, late 70s.
What would you say has been the greatest moment of your curling career?
Meeting my husband probably was the, you know, if I were to look and say, boy, that changed the trajectory. And he was a really good player as well. So meeting Scott was great. But without a doubt, winning the 1982 Scotties, long before we went on the run of five from 99 to 2000 and whatever, winning that first one changed the trajectory of my life because it opened up the media door for me, and it got me into radio, and then it got me into television, and then it changed whatever I was going to do with my life, and the door was kicked open for me, and that literally changed everything. I mean, to be able to become a storyteller and a broadcaster was, you know, really such the thrill of a lifetime. And it brought me so much joy meeting so many people through all of the different interviews I did. You get to know people, you get to understand them. It was, I love curling, loved all of that. But I have loved my broadcasting career probably more.
Well, you have signed
maybe not
off.
More. Wait a minute. Maybe not more. Maybe it's equal. Yeah. And I'm also babysitting my grandson, Nay, at times as much as I can. And he's just the joy of my life. What everybody says about being a grandparent is so true. So I'm doing that, and I'm paddle boarding, and I do my hot cold therapy, and I just want to go for a ride on that open road, like Bruce Springsteen might say in a song.
The late Colleen Jones speaking with Sunday Magazine guest host Robin Bresnahan in 2023.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me, and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself alone again. Don't run back inside, darling, you know just what I'm here for. So you're scared and you're thinking that maybe we ain't that young anymore. Show a little faith, there's magic in the night. You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're alright.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.